This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
What kind of programs does this school have? How are the test scores? How many kids do a classroom? Homes.com knows these are all things you ask when you're home shopping as a parent. That's why each listing on Homes.com includes extensive reports on local schools, including photos, parent reviews, test scores, student-teacher ratio, school rankings, and more. The information is from multiple trusted sources and curated by Homes.com's dedicated in-house research team. It's all so you can make the right decision for your family. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
All right, here we go. 6:12, Monday morning, May 5th, Cinco de Mayo. But I think that's cliche. Instead, I'm going to go with, since yesterday was May the 4th and May the 4th be with you, I'm going to make today May the 5th. Be with you. May the 5th be with you, and you can make it a fifth of whatever you want. Dry, pleasant today, but the storm chances ramp up. According to Peyton Malone, WWL Louisiana forecaster, Tuesday through Thursday, bringing the risk for heavy rain and street flooding. So be aware of that. Not that there's really anything you can do about it, but just, I guess, keep in the back of your mind, nice today, highs of 82, sunny, less humid. Then tomorrow, and through Thursday, a chance for showers, primarily Wednesday and Thursday, but I'm not sure that they have a handle on this, so it might rain hard, and when it does, the streets could flood. That's a hell of a thing to tell you, but I think that's about where we stand. Brian Taylor joins us now, our friend, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University. His most recent book is Russia Politics, A Very Short Introduction. Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Tommy?
I'm okay. So tell me about the book. That intrigues me, the title.
The book is part of a series that Oxford University Press puts out called Very Short Introductions, and there's a very short introduction to pretty much anything your listeners might want, from rock and roll to black holes to Shakespeare to whatever, and so I was asked to write the very short introduction to Russian politics. So it's a tiny little book. If you want a physical copy, it'll fit in your pocket. Lots of people I know read them on other platforms, but it tries to be an introduction to someone who wants to know more about Russia and Russian politics, but is kind of new to the topic.
I love that idea because I always like to learn about stuff, and life is not a picture, right? It's a still photograph. It's a motion picture of where we came from and how we got here. How did Russian politics and the U.S. specifically relations get to where they are today? If you can kind of give me a little thumbnail on it, Professor.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long story, obviously, but to get to the heart of it, there have been a variety of efforts since the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 to try and remake the U.S.-Russia relationship. There was a lot of hope when the Cold War ended that, you know, peace would break out and we would all get along and all of those sorts of things. Obviously, a lot has happened since then, and it hasn't worked out that way. And from my point of view, the thing that has broken the relationship most of all has been the Russian war against Ukraine, which started in 2014 when Russia annexed through military force the territory of Crimea. And then, of course, three plus years ago, it launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Now, one could step back and say there were things the U.S. did that also annoyed the Russians, and that's certainly true, but launching the biggest war in Europe since World War II certainly changed the tenor of the relationship between Russia and the U.S. and the West in general.
So when it comes to Crimea and Vladimir Putin in 2014, right? I think I got my year right, annexing Crimea. Gorbachev would never have done that under Reagan, right? So what changed with the relationship where Putin felt empowered to do that? Because part of breaking up the Soviet Union, Crimea was part of breaking up the Soviet Union with Reagan and Gorbachev. Correct me if I just said something to hurt myself. I don't mean to, Professor.
Well, when the Soviet Union fell apart in 1991, it broke into 15 new states, two of which were Russia and Ukraine, but there were others as well that your listeners will have heard of, from Estonia to Georgia to Kazakhstan to whatever. Mm-hmm. But according to the boundaries that existed at the time, Crimea was part of Ukraine. And so those were its legitimate international boundaries. But some Russians, including Putin, felt that that wasn't fair and thought that Crimea should be given to Russia instead of to Ukraine. I don't think there's any legitimacy in that view under international law. They would point to some things in history, but, you know, history tells us lots of things. But the way the world order tends to work now is the borders on the map that are agreed to by the UN and by other countries are the ones we try and live by. Otherwise, it would create chaos. So I think the question of why Putin felt emboldened in 2014 to do what he did is simply that Ukraine at the time was relatively weak. It was outside any alliances, and Putin felt that, you know, he'd been distrusted and mistreated. And I think this was kind of an emotional reaction to a revolution that took place in Ukraine that changed the government from a pro-Russian one to a pro-Western one. And that's what ultimately precipitated his annexation of Crimea. And
so,
it started the war that we're sort of still seeing today in its first form.
All right, so Barack Obama was president then. What options did he have, either as the United States alone or with the UN? What could have been done at that point? And if anything had, what would have been the Russian response? And would we be where we are today?
Yeah, some things were done. I mean, the most obvious were a series of sanctions were put in place by the U.S. and its European allies on Russian finance and arms industry and energy industry. And it was condemned by the United Nations General Assembly. But no one felt like the U.S. or any other countries were in a position to go to war over this. And in fact, Ukraine at the time didn't even have the military wherewithal to try and resist very much when this happened in February 2014. It was only after Russia sort of expanded its operations in the southeastern part of Ukraine, an area that we know as the Donbas, that the war that started in 2014 sort of broke out. So what else could Obama have done? I think probably the main problem was there was a bit more of a return to business as usual than there should have been. And maybe more could have done to prepare Ukraine for what happened in 2022. Although the Obama administration and the first Trump administration would say, well, we did some things to help Ukraine get stronger. We did a lot of military training with Ukraine under President Trump in the first term. A decision was made to provide these anti-tank missiles called Javelins. So there were some things that were done. And if we look at how Ukraine did when Russia invaded in 2022, it did much better, obviously. And although Putin thought he was going to march into Kyiv and take it over in a couple of weeks, here we are more than 3 years later, and they've haven't moved that far in the last 2.5 years.
Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Brian Taylor, director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs, Maxwell School at Syracuse University. Most recent book, Russian Politics, a very short introduction. It's part of the, had it right in front of me here, a series of very short introductions as the computer screen refreshes and screws me over, but I'll tell you about it later. 620 traffic now, WWL.
I'll be buying one of them books from the Acadian Windows and Hurricane Shutters WWL Traffic Center. I'm Joe Cardosi. The Bonnie Carey Spillway has no delays as you head in from LaPlace. I-10 is also free and clear between Kenner and Metairie, and the causeway is looking good to and from the North Shore. No delays across the Twin Spans as you head in from Slidell, and smooth sailing through the Morrison Curve and across the high rise as well. As you head downtown from the east on I-10, you're moving fine all the way through the Claiborne flyover. The Pontchartrain Expressway is also free and clear as you head toward the CBD. Moving in from the West Bank, smooth sailing across the Crescent City connection, and you're seeing no delays in either direction across the Huey P. This morning's traffic is brought to you by Terminix.
626, Tommy Tucker, WWL. It's Very Short Introductions, a book series published by the Oxford University Press. Brian Taylor, our guest director of the Moynihan Institute of Global Affairs at the Maxwell School at Syracuse University, wrote Russian Politics, a Very Short Introduction. Professor, so, you know, the last time Zelensky, the head of Ukraine, and Trump met in the Oval Office, it was ugly. Then they met again last week, as I understand it, at Pope Francis's funeral. What is the latest on ending the war in Ukraine? And I guess maybe first off, we should say, what is the status of the war in Ukraine right now? Everybody still bombing each other?
Yeah, the war goes on as it has for 3-plus years now. In fact, in some ways, Russian attacks on cities in Ukraine have increased over the past few months while these negotiations have been going on. So there's no real change in terms of the war, no major change. The fighting goes on every day. There's been a lot of talk, as your listeners know, about a possible ceasefire, and there were times when it looked like they might be close to some type of at least partial ceasefire, but none of that has taken place. And so, you know, we're well past the 24 hours President Trump said he would need to end the war, or more recently they were talking about a settlement by Easter or by the first 100 days, and we're past all those barriers now. So I think the real question is what's going to happen over the coming sort of month or so, and is the U.S. eventually going to walk away? But you're right to point out that the relationship between President Trump and President Zelensky looks a bit better than it did than in that famous Oval Office meeting at the end of February.
So when it comes to options, be it the United States or the world, if Russia says, no, we're going to keep fight, if first of all, if Russia can keep fighting Ukraine, do they have unlimited resources, or are they about out as well as Ukraine? Ukraine's being propped up by the United States. Russia's in it alone, or is China helping them, Professor?
So Russia does have the wherewithal to continue, at least for a while, I would say. They're not running out of men or money or military equipment yet. It is correct, as you note, that they get some help from a variety of countries. From China, it's mostly that China buys a lot of Russian oil, and they provide a lot of dual-use technologies that Russia can use to make weapons. Probably the biggest outside supporter is actually North Korea, which sent 12,000 troops to fight in the war and also provides as much as half of their artillery that Russia is using at the front lines. So Russia has a few supporters. Ukraine has a lot more supporters, not only the United States, but the entire NATO alliance and some other countries around the world have been providing military assistance and economic assistance. But of course, Ukraine's a smaller country than Russia, so this outside assistance is probably more important for Ukraine than the assistance Russia gets, although it's important on both sides. But
let me give you my biggest
fear.
I'm sorry, Professor. Just my biggest fear in the minute that we have left is that Russia decides to either continue what they're doing in Ukraine or even advance and try to reclaim some more of the old Soviet Union. China backs them, and they stand fast, and they say, you know what? You want to go nuclear war? Let's go nuclear war. At what point does the United States say, well, we're not going to do that? That's crazy. And do China and Russia get to do whatever they want? Or are China and Russia that aligned against, could they be that aligned against the United States?
At the moment, they're not that aligned where I could imagine Russia and China sort of entering into a war with the U.S. or any other target together. I mean, they're so-called partners, but they're not military allies. So I would not expect that. I do think that we're still a long ways away from a settlement, unfortunately. Vladimir Putin isn't really interested in a deal. He's interested in what he would define as victory, which is the subjugation of Ukraine to Russian control. And your listeners probably remember Senator Kennedy said a few days ago that Putin has jacked around our president on every opportunity, and he suggested putting more pressure on Russia by making it harder for them to sell their oil, which I think would be a good thing for the U.S. to do at this point.
Thank you, Professor. Appreciate your time and your insight. We'll take a break, come back, talk about trade deficits right now. Time for WWL First News. 6:45, quarter till 7. You know, President Trump, a lot of people get their hair on fire over stuff that he says, and I'm hoping, I'm convinced that he says stuff just to get a reaction out of people, or he just speaks off the top of his head and it really means nothing. Sometimes presidents, years ago somebody asked me about Barack Obama, why he was so measured at a press conference. I said that's because, well, whatever a president says matters, his words matter. But I think with President Trump, he speaks so freely, I don't know if it's the same, if they carry the same weight anymore. And yesterday he told Kristen Welker, I think, with Meet the Press, that he didn't know if he had to obey the Constitution or follow the Constitution. I think that's something that he just, stuff like that, I know people get worried about it, but I think he just either doesn't understand the magnitude of the question or is tugging the chain of some people to see how they react. He also had this to say when she asked him about the economy and tariffs and recession and so forth. Obviously, everything's not okay, and I think he just sometimes says some stuff to say stuff. Tarak Hassan joins us, professor of economics at Boston University, talk about trade deficits, tariffs, all that stuff. How you doing, Professor?
Hi, good morning, Tommy.
Last time you were on with us, you kind of predicted something that was going to happen that day, and it had to do with currency and how it's not just all about the tariffs, but there's a lot more to this than I tariff you, and then it costs the manufacturer so much that they start producing these products in America, correct?
Yes, correct.
Explain a little bit more about that, please, if you would, and where that could fit into all of this economic puzzle with recession or stock market growth, et cetera, because the economy is comprised of a lot of different things.
Yeah, that's right. And it looks like we're already heading for a recession, so things are not looking all that great. I guess the first thing I'd say is that the tariffs are not really designed to bring manufacturing back to the U.S. And the reason is simple. We're all sitting here waiting for them to go away. Mm-hmm. So essentially, it now looks increasingly like the administration is looking for an off-ramp. If I'm going to move a manufacturing plant to the United States, then I need to know that, you know, the incentives for me to do so have to be in place for, you know, decades. And we're all sitting here waiting for the tariffs to go away, maybe next week. So that's why manufacturers are certainly not moving production back to the U.S. The other thing that I was worried about a couple of weeks ago and that I'm still worried about is the role of the dollar and sort of the damage that all of this policy is doing to our ability to finance our very large budget deficit.
You need to explain that a little more and in layman's terms if you can, Professor, because we're not all professors of economics at Boston University, but you understand what I'm saying, if you can, how that factors into this, because it is a key part, and I think a lot of people skip over that.
Yeah, so I think maybe the most important thing to know about our trade deficit is that it arises not from unfairness, but it arises from the fact that Americans in general, and in particular the federal government, is spending a lot more than it's taking in. So if you look at the size of the federal budget deficit and you look at the size of the trade deficit, they're, you know, very comparable. And basically what that means is that the federal government is borrowing money from foreigners so that we have to pay less taxes today. And when you, I don't know what a delicate way of saying this is, when you kick the foreigners, you're kicking them in their private parts with these tariffs, they might not be willing to continue financing our budget deficit. And that will raise interest rates. And when it raises interest rates, the federal budget deficit doesn't look as sustainable as it once was. And also the cost of borrowing for everyone will go up. And that's something that often in other countries happens very quickly. It's not one of these things that, you know, sometimes economic changes take a long time. So right now we're going to be waiting for a couple of months about, like, for prices to go up. That's something that happens slowly. Interest rates typically change with a bang. And that's really the thing that we were most worried about. When it looks like the government is behaving in a very irresponsible way, foreigners can just turn off the tap.
Basically. Who finances? Who are we borrowing money from to avoid paying more taxes to service the debt that we have as a country?
Yeah, it's a little hard to say. So it's basically lots of people abroad. People often say it's China, but that's not actually really true. It's mainly foreign banks who like holding U.S. treasuries to conduct their daily business. Mm-hmm. So think about it this way. The dollar is not just our currency. It's also the currency used by lots and lots of people abroad. And what that basically enables us to do is to print T-bills, print government bonds, and print currency, literal currency, like $1 trillion of cash are circulating outside of the U.S., and they're used to basically settle payments between people in very far away places. So it's foreign banks and just foreign individuals who like using the dollar in their daily business. Now, if it looks like the dollar is a less stable currency, they're going to stop doing that. And that's basically, we're giving up an opportunity that we've gotten very used to, which is effectively what we're doing is we're printing pieces of paper. We're giving them to people abroad. They're giving us goods in return. And to an increasing degree.
Wait, let me pick it up there. We come back. Let me pick it up there. We come back, and we'll make it about Fred and Charlie. How about that? If we can do that, and maybe we'll understand it a little bit better about printing pieces of paper in exchange for goods, and then tie that into how that works with tariffs. Every tariff that has been collected so far, all of that money has gone to the U.S. Treasury. Is that accurate?
That's right. Okay. But that's not going to be. It's just a tax. Yeah.
That's what I'm saying. So for people that think that China's being punished or whomever, every tariff that has been collected that has been paid by people in America has gone to the U.S. Treasury, correct?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, the importer, the person who's importing a good into the U.S. pays the tariff and does go to the U.S. Treasury. That's right.
Just wanted to clear that up. 6:52 more. We come back 8 till 7. Traffic now, WWL. 6:58, I'm in a hurry to get back to Tarak Hassan, professor of economics at Boston University. Professor, you're going to have to come back in the 9 o'clock hour central one day so we can just do this World Finance Econ 101, an introduction, if you will. I'm going to call an audible, forget the question I asked you. Somebody texted in. We all presume that the economy in China is rolling along and they have no problems. Tell me, if you will, what's the situation with the economy in China, and have the threat of, or have these tariffs affected the Chinese economy at all?
I think they're beginning to affect the economy in China. The Chinese have been through a lot in the last couple of years, so I'm not sure if that ranks like among their top concerns, but it's certainly, I do think the Chinese are worried. Maybe not as worried as U.S. businesses. The big difference is that as Americans, we've just picked a fight with the entire world. So we're 20% of GDP. The rest of the world is 80% of GDP. We've picked a tariff fight with everyone at once. The Chinese only have a tariff fight with us. So that's the big difference.
All right. I appreciate your time, Professor. I hope we talk to you again soon and spend a lot of time on this and go into detail and take listeners' questions, because it is very, very complicated stuff. We'll take a break. We come back. May is World Cancer Research Month. We're going to talk with Dr. Lucio Millet about where treatment stands now. He's with LSU. Now we're going to help you take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa. 7:15. Today's going to be nice and spring-like on this Cinco de Mayo, but then we got a chance for some heavy weather coming in tomorrow, and primarily, well, actually, tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday, all 3 days, maybe some street flooding, those kind of things. Friday, really, through the week, now that I look at it, and highs around 80, so it's going to be a wet, rainy week, and we'll have to make sure that all the pumps are turned on and the power's working and everything else. But either way, we live underwater, and you need to remember that when it rains. Dr. Lucio Mille joins us now, Director of LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center, to talk about Cancer Awareness Month. Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
I am okay, sir. It is actually World Cancer Research Month, and we're going to talk where treatments stand now, the importance of funding new research, and how AI is helping with early detection. Doctor, let's start with some of the advancements, maybe like 10 years ago, things that have changed in 10, 15, 20 years, where people now, if they had gotten the diagnosis then, would not be in such good shape, and things are different now.
Well, the two biggest changes in terms of treatment have been precision oncology and immunotherapy. Precision oncology consists in looking at what genes are mutated, changed in a specific cancer from a specific patient, and choosing treatment based on that. This is now routine, and if that was not the case 10 years ago, and it would have been science fiction 30 years ago. Mm. Immunotherapy consists of stimulating the patient's immune system to more actively fight cancer. That's a result of decades of immunology research that started in the 90s. And by now, it's standard of care. Multiple cancers are treated with so-called checkpoint inhibitors. These are things that take the brakes off the immune system so that the immune system can attack cancers more effectively. I just heard yesterday from a dear friend of mine. He's receiving immunotherapy. He's got a diagnosis that would have killed him rapidly, and he's responding beautifully. Mm. So things are changing, and they're changing pretty dramatically. Since 1991, the number of cancer, the mortality from cancer has decreased by a third.
Wow. And the reason for that is research and well-funded research, Doctor?
Well, yeah, absolutely. So when I went to medical school, all we knew about cancer is what you could see under a microscope. There has been a technological revolution that's entirely due to research. The molecular genetics revolution, the immunology revolution, and now AI. I just came from the conference of the American Association for Cancer Research. 22,000 scientists and doctors joined together in Chicago to talk about the latest discoveries. And one of the most exciting talks was an AI algorithm that is trained to read slides. You know, when somebody has cancer, you do a biopsy, you cut a thin slice of the tumor, and you look at it under the microscope. What a human can see is just cells. But when you train an AI to correlate the appearance of that tumor with the genetic changes that that thousands and thousands of tumors that look like that have, the AI can look at the slide and predict what you should be treating that patient with. As I said, this would have been Star Trek stuff when I went to medical school, and it's all due to research primarily funded by the National Cancer Institute.
So to make this extremely simpler than it really is, it would be a tantamount, Doc, with the AI to, rather than having a person go through, this photo is of this person and going through this photo one at a time and flipping them over till you find one that matches, the AI does it, goes through millions of them instantly, pretty much. Yes?
That's exactly right. And it's being taught to recognize new features by studying millions and millions of cases. It contains a lot more in its memory than any human can.
It's amazing. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Talking to Dr. Lucio Mille, a Malay, director of the LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center. It is World Cancer Research Month, and you heard him talk about some of the breakthroughs with and where treatments stand now. If you have any questions or comments, the Oakland Heart Jeweler text me line is open at 504-260-1870. We'll talk about different types of cancers and are there more gains in one area than the other and where the work still needs to be done when we return. 720, traffic now, WWL. 725, Tommy Tucker, WWL, May, And today is May 5th. May is World Cancer Research Month, and we're talking with our friend Dr. Lucio Millay, the director of the LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center, about some of the advances that have been made, how AI has helped significantly. Doctor texted in about pancreatic cancer, and I had mentioned before the break we were talking about different types of cancers and where work still needs to be done and where a lot of progress has been made, and I'll leave it after this to you to explain. Are there areas of cancer research that are doing better than others?
Yes. So the best defense against cancer is finding it early. We know how to find certain cancers early because there are validated screenings. For example, breast cancer, colon cancer, cancer of the uterine cervix. These are all things we can screen for. The most difficult ones are cancers that are hard to screen and that don't give symptoms until it's too late. Pancreatic cancer is one of them. Brain cancer is another. What's going on in that field is two things that are very exciting. One is looking for tiny amounts of tumor DNA in the blood of patients. It's like a needle in a haystack because the blood contains a lot of normal DNA. So there are technologies that are being developed now that can distinguish tumor DNA from the normal DNA and tell you, aha, there's something going on here. Now, we know from all the research that has been going on until now, what are the most common mutations in genes in pancreatic cancer? So that should alert physicians that maybe there's something going on in the pancreas, and then you can start doing imaging, MRIs, and other diagnostic procedures. You can't screen for it with a simple technology, but you can look for tumor DNA in the blood. There are a few tests that are already on the market and better ones that are being developed. In terms of treatment, one of the most exciting news was a trial of a combination of personalized cancer vaccines for pancreatic cancer. It basically involves this: taking the tumor out, reading the genes in the tumor to figure out which ones are changed, and then making a mixture of vaccines against the things that are changed in that particular tumor and giving it to the patient. That trial happened a couple of years ago, and it gave quite striking results. So that's an area of very active development.
I know this is a general question, but I'm getting a lot of texts about pancreatic cancer. I know people that have died of pancreatic cancer. It seems as though
I do too.
It's not. I don't know if it's hard to treat. I don't know if it's because, as you're saying, and that's what I'm asking now, because it's hard to diagnose and it's advanced. But is that about the worst type of cancer you can get? Pancreatic cancer, and why do so many people die so quickly from pancreatic cancer? I guess the question.
Yeah, it is. It is one of the worst, and part of the reason, as I said, it can't be diagnosed easily. The other one is that pancreatic cancers have a lot of connective tissue. So the cancer cells are buried in a big wall of hard fibrous tissue. Mm. So reaching them with medication is harder than it is for other cancers. Now, we do know some risk factors for pancreatic cancers that can limit our risk. One of them is excessive use of alcohol, smoking, obesity. All these things can increase our risk of pancreatic cancer. As I said, the best hope is much earlier diagnosis by looking for tumor DNA in blood.
So should people be checked for that or screened for that? I don't know if you would call it pancreatic cancer screening. What would you advise people, Doc?
Mass screening isn't ready yet. We need more research. But there are a few products that screen for tumor DNA that are already available. They are good, but not fantastic. You need enough tumor DNA to detect it. And there are products that are being researched right now that can really look for few molecules of tumor DNA in blood. And these are going to be revolutionary in terms of our ability to detect it early.
Thank you, sir.
As I said, the best defense is finding it early.
I appreciate your time. I really do, in a healthy lifestyle. Dr. Lucio Mille, director of the LSU LCMC Health Cancer Center. Some good news on the in the world of cancer research. Some not so good news when it comes to pancreatic cancer. We'll take a break. Come back. Take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, president and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. Somebody texting in wanted to know about somebody to talk about tariffs and why they could work. Well, Mark's going to do that when we return. Time now, WWL First News. 7:45, quarter till 8, Monday morning. That means it's time to take a look at the week ahead on Wall Street. Monday morning markets with Mark Rosa, president and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. How you doing, Mark?
Good morning, sir. How are you?
Good. One of the reasons we drafted Mark was because of his flexibility and the fact that he's always available. He's always on the field. You can't play with who you don't have, right? But he's extremely flexible as well, because today we're going to talk about some stuff, and we still will, about GDP and inflation numbers and so forth. But Mark is going to take on tariffs and China and what's going on there, because somebody texted in and said something to the effect of, would you find somebody that thinks tariffs can work, or everybody talks about tariffs not working. Can you find a financial guy that thinks they're going to work? So talk about tariffs in China and all that, Mark, if you will, please.
Tom, what I think is a big thing, I don't hold myself out as a tariff expert, but I think if Trump wants to be a transformational president, and I think a lot of us could call him that, and he wanted to tackle a lot of things in the economy, and he needs to do it in a way that it can come out of his office and not go through Congress. So he's one of the few, I think, economic levers that he wants to pull, and he's putting a lot of pressure against Powell to lower interest rates, for instance. If it was up to him, he would lower them, whether it was time to do it or not. But the government is separated sufficiently that he doesn't have everything at his disposal. Tariffs are one. But what I think is a bigger thing, you had an economist on a little earlier this morning talking about the value of the dollar and all these things. What about the deficit? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's the other thing that Trump said he wanted to.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Want to pull off the season's freshest trends? You just need the right shoes. That's where Designer Shoe Warehouse comes in. Loving wide-leg jeans? Pair them with sleek, low-profile sneakers. Obsessed with the sheer trend? Try it with mesh flats. Feeling boho? Comfy sandals nail the whole free-spirited thing. Find on-trend shoes from the brands you love, like Birkenstock, Nike, Adidas, and more at DSW.
Hi, this is Javon, your Blinds.com design consultant.
Oh, wow, a real person.
Yep, I'm here to help with everything from selecting the perfect window treatments to...
Well, I've got a complicated project.
No problem. We make the complex simple. I can even help schedule a professional measure and install.
I didn't realize you did that.
We can also send you samples fast and free.
Wow. I mean, I always thought I needed a designer to come to my home, but scheduling's always a nightmare.
Not with Blinds.com. We're on your schedule, and there's no haggling, pressure, or hidden fees either.
I just might have to do more.
Whatever you need. How about you tell me what you had in mind?
Okay, then. So the first room we're looking at is for guests coming over, and I'm thinking of something...
Blinds.com has covered over 25 million windows, all backed by a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com now and get up to 50% off with minimum purchase. Rules and restrictions may apply.
How can advertising on TikTok help jumpstart sales for your small business?
Thanks to TikTok ads, I was able to open up a business with my childhood friend, get a warehouse, and even hire employees. My name is Julian, and I am one of the founders of The Snacks Lab. We are an exotic snack company. We had over $100,000 in sales from our TikTok ads in the first month. So our orders went from 5 a day to over 250 orders a day. You definitely have to use TikTok ads, and you gotta start now.
Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.
Balance the budget eventually, get the deficits under control, because if anything's out of control, it's that. We're the largest economy in the world, and we're running $36 trillion and adding another trillion every 90 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, to say it's unsustainable, I know it's an overly used word, but I think it's the best way to describe it. If that doesn't, if we don't tackle that tiger, I think it's going to be like a Mad Max future when it gets, you know, 50, 60 trillion. And there's no way to, I'm thinking it's, you know, it might take 100 years to bring it down. If the goal was to bring it to zero and really, you know, stood shoulder to shoulder as a country and said, okay, we've got to tackle this. We've got to start paying it down. You've got to cut expenses. Or the other way is to grow your way out of it. I don't think you can grow your way out of it just completely. I think you got to do all of these things because the number's too big.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, GDP came in. Let me do a couple of these. I'll get back to what we were saying. But the GDP came in for the first quarter, first negative number since 2022. And, Tommy, when you and I were undergrads, you got two negative GDP quarters and you called it a recession. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the definition has separated itself from the old ways that you and I learned what a recession was. But it's what drove it to negative territory was interesting. It was to talk about the tariffs, and all of us, meaning Americans, started buying stuff in record amounts from overseas. So the gross domestic product, GDP, is for goods and services that are produced within the country. What if you buy a BMW from out of the country? Well, that subtracts from GDP. So if you had enough subtractions, it's going to drive your own numbers down and eventually go below zero and hit a negative. So it was the car sales hit a four-year high, and we bought so damn much coming over, so that had to be explained. At first, when I heard the soundbite last week that GDP was negative, it's like, oh, they were expecting some reductions in economic activity for the first quarter. Last year was up 2.4%, a decent number. I'd rather it be higher, but that's what we got.
Mm-hmm.
And then when economists were talking about, well, the first quarter might be a challenge. Well, that was when new administration was talking about tariffs back then, and that was the result. So, you know, consumer spending was ahead of expectations, and it just goes back to what I was saying, that we bought a lot of stuff trying to get ahead of the price changes that were expected within the tariffs. So back to kind of discussing all these tariffs, what has Wall Street done? Well, when April 2nd kicked in and he was really, really leaning into them, the first quarter was a conversation about tariffs and just nibbling around. But at April 2nd, I think a lot of people have a tattoo of that date on there, someplace on them, saying, boy, when that really kicked in and the markets didn't like that. Well, just about 1 month, okay, so bring it to today, the S&P has recovered all of the sell-off. So Wall Street has gotten a handle on this, and I think the smart money, I would call them that, is they're getting their hands around it and realizing it's an economic tool, and I don't think it's going to stay around for long at all. And I think when the complicated part, which it's hard to discuss quickly, is when all these tariffs go in, they get complicated. You've got parts or things that you would buy from other countries that, you know, some parts of whatever, let's say a cell phone, you got some parts that are made in one country, you got some other parts that are possibly made in another country, you got the phone being assembled yet in a third country before it comes over here. So put all that together in the proper construct where the tariffs are, that's what gets busy and that's what gets difficult. But I think it's just been a tool. China's been accused, at least, of taking advantage of us in a number of ways, anything from, you know, copyright infringements and stealing secrets. And I don't know what extent that's true, but it seems like all the people that do a lot of trade with them accuse them of that. And they manipulate their currency to their advantage. So I know for a fact that China's in bad shape right now. They're in a recession, and they have been. And this is going to, they're sitting up straight when container ship after container ship has either been turned around or it's just sitting out there with goods coming in, but they can't sell them. So their whole economy is built to do that, is to make everything you can, everything under the sun, and sell it as much as you can. Of course, they sell us the stuff. How many times have you looked at something and it says made in China?
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. But they, of course, get the money, and then they could reinvest that money in ways that would benefit their economy. But I think they're having a hard time, and most of the modern economies right now across the world are having a bad time. Germany, the fourth largest economy, is basically in recession. Japan has been in recession for 25 years. because they have the highest, talk about debt to GDP ratio, it's probably 250%. So, you know, all these countries are having a lot of trouble, and we're still here with relatively low interest rates, and we complain about the financing rate. Talk about, I was just speaking to somebody in Russia over email, and he works in a financial institution. He works at a credit union. So, what's a loan? He said 33%. That's how they're dealing with all that's going on over there, plus the inflation that was going over there. So I said, well, how many loans are you making at 33%? Well, not very many. You know, so all of it, they're in way worse shape than we are. Mm-hmm. And it's just like we continue to be the largest economy, and there's a lot of reason for that. And that's where how I would be explaining to whatever it's worth, as far as what these tariffs are doing. They're waking up a lot of countries to the trade deals. And I don't think any of the typical career-minded politicians, none of them would tackle these targets. None of them. None of them are going to talk about the budget deficit. Newt Gingrich is the only one that keeps saying, oh, we balanced the budget for 4 years back in the Clinton administration, and we thought we had something going, and then it fell off that wagon, and we've just been increasing the number ever since. But it would get to a point, if we have some economists on to say, okay, how do you get this budget deficit down? They'll tell you it's only a couple of ways to do it. Either you print a bunch of money, we know what that's going to turn out like, and you just start paying it down. That's not going to work. You grow your way out of it. We can't grow that fast. The number, I think, is too big. Or you really have austerity measures, the likes of which there'd be riots in the street if you said, okay, we're going to cut down, you know, regardless. There's no safe haven. Social Security could be touched, Medicare, all the big ticket items, all the things that are the largest parts contributing to the deficit. If you're going to pull back on those, I don't think that would end well. So, okay, well, then what happens? Well, you kick the can down the road, and by the time you catch up to it, it's a bigger can.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate it. Complicated stuff, but you did a good job of explaining it. I appreciate it. Monday Morning Markets with Mark Rosa, President and CEO of Jefferson Financial Federal Credit Union. He'll be back Friday when we help you manage your money. 7:54, 6 till 8, traffic now, WWL. 8:14, sunny day today. Nice day today, but it's going to turn rainy all week, so we'll be aware of street flooding, and if it potentially comes down too fast to pump, and if the pumps are working, if the power's working, blah, 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 blah. Tim Temple joins us now, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. How you doing, Tim?
Good morning, Tommy. It's starting off as a pretty day. We'll see how it goes.
I don't mean to blah, 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 make it seem insignificant, but it's always something, especially when it comes to insurance. Let me read from this story here, Louisiana Illuminator. By Wesley Muller, talented writer, quoting a legislator Glorioso as saying that if a cause and effect, I guess a quid pro quo with what if they can say for certain whether this bill would lower premiums, that he said if that's the standard by which we're going to pass insurance bills, we may as well go home, saying that such guarantees would be impossible to make. And it is hard to find, Tim, you're the insurance commissioner, you tell me, a quid pro quo where if we do this, then the insurance company will do that? These are all just estimates or what? Tell me about linkage.
Yeah, well, look, I mean, one of the things that the party of status quo, the people that don't want anything to change with regards to legal reform, they pull this out of their playbook every single time legislation's passed. You know, it's like, well, if you can't guarantee or if we can't mandate a rate change, then we shouldn't do it. But let me tell you, Tommy, I want your listeners to understand, Florida has done it. Georgia has done it. Texas is in the process of doing it. South Carolina has tried to do it. Oklahoma is in the process of doing it. There are states all around this country that are tackling legal reform, and their legislatures and their governors and everybody else are not, you know, pounding the table saying you have to mandate. It works, though. The proof is in the pudding, as they say. Last year, we passed property reform. I've already approved 8 property companies filing for rate decreases for 2025. They filed for those decreases not because I told them to do it, mm-hmm. not because it was a mandate or a guarantee in legislation. They did it because the laws change. It allows them to be more competitive. And when companies are competitive, we benefit with lower premiums. Period. End of story.
So when it comes to what is making its way through the legislature and in turn the insurance companies will take note of, Let me take a step back first. Tim Temple, insurance commissioner. Before an insurance company can get an increased auto rate, they go before you and you have to approve it. Is that the way it works?
They have to file. Yes, they have to come to the department and they submit a filing, a rate change, mm-hmm. up or down. Either way, both. They have to get approved.
Do they go down often or not?
Well, yeah, look, I just approved 8 decreases in 2025 for property reform mm-hmm. because of the laws that were passed. So, yeah, they do go down.
Okay.
But they have to come to the department. They have to bring their math, if you will. And they have to justify, actuarially justify. It means the numbers, right. The math has to add up that the premium that they're asking for is adequate to cover the risk that they're assuming. It can't be excessive, meaning too much. And it can't be inadequate, meaning too little. If it's inadequate, then that would indicate when they have claims that they're not going to be able to pay those claims. If it's excessive, that means that they're asking more than what the risk that they're covering. And I have 39 times since I've been commissioner of insurance, I have told insurance companies with their rate filings, go back because the math does not add up. In addition to that, 21 times I've told companies your rates are excessive. They're too high for what the risk you're assuming. Go back and either withdraw your filing or resubmit a different rate. So I have the authority today. So the people that want to say that I don't are being, at best, disingenuous.
For people that don't know, and I know somebody that became an actuary, it takes about 7 to 10 years of school to do that, same as medical school or even more. It gets very complicated. It is the basis for the insurance industry, and that's why, Tim, I think it's important that you are the insurance commissioner because you know the game from the inside out, correct?
Yeah, look, I'll tell you, Tommy, you're right. Actuaries, I mean, they are highly skilled, highly trained. And our actuaries, we have several on staff. You know, they don't just rubber stamp or approve everything that comes across their desk. They go back to the insurance company actuary.
Think Tim's phone cut out, so what we're going to do is take a break here for traffic early if we can and pick it up when we come back because it's very important. And I will say, if y'all have any questions about it, and I'm getting some texts coming in here on the Oakland Art Jeweler text me line. Bill's introduced to remove the credit criteria from automobile insurance. We'll talk about that with Tim Temple when we come back. 820 traffic now, WWL. It is 8:25. Tommy Tucker, WWL, back with Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. There aren't a lot of fun movies about insurance, but I'll tell you what, if you watch from way back in the day, Double Indemnity with Fred McMurray, I like my old movies, Tim Temple. It might explain to you a little bit about what an actuary does and how they go about computing risk and what makes sense and what doesn't. With all that being said, somebody texted in about credit rating and insurance companies and taking that out as a determining factor in auto insurance rates. Is there any, how important is that to insurance companies, and are there any bills in the legislature making their way through that would eliminate that?
Yeah, Tommy, I think there is a bill that addresses that, but the vast majority, and I want to say it's somewhere in the 40s, states allow credit rating. Mm-hmm. So let's talk numbers,
and let's talk the actuarial part of it, Tim, for people that don't understand. Why is that important, and why do people with better credit get lower insurance rates?
Well, I think one of the things that the data would support is those with better credit are less likely to file what I would call a nuisance claim, mm-hmm. right? Something you may get a small fender bender, you know, something that's not vastly expensive. And so obviously the less you use insurance, then the less the claims are and the less the premiums are going to be as a result of that. And, you know, premiums follow claims. The more claims a state has, as a whole, then the more expensive the premiums are going to be. And that's one of the things that we've been looking at. So credit scoring is one. I know I've seen some data that said if credit score goes away, then think about it. People with good credit are going to pay more. Mm-hmm. And that's a conversation that we need to have. And if the people of Louisiana decide that that's what they want to, you know, that's something that they want to change in Louisiana, then, then the legislature will pass it, the governor will sign it, and we'll regulate and hold insurance companies accountable that way.
Let's talk about the prescribed damages, however you phrase it. Explain what that is, how important that is, and are any bills advancing that would address that when it comes to either soft tissue damage and what the insurance company actually pay, or what the patient actually pays, or out-of-pocket and what the insurance company pays, and who's reimbursed, et cetera. Explain that, Tim, please.
Yeah, and there are several bills that are working their way through the process right now that address, and I think is referred to now as medical transparency.
Okay.
And when you get in an accident and you have medical bills and you seek treatment, you know, most people use their health insurance. They pay for it, and that's part of what health insurance is for. So they use health insurance. But then if you hired an attorney and you seek reimbursement for that, your attorney is bringing what was billed, so not what was paid. And we all know that the billed amount is always much higher than the paid amount because healthcare providers negotiate lower, they negotiate discounts. And what's happening is sometimes referred to as phantom damages, unjust reward. People are getting more than their healthcare provider actually paid out. So that's one. And the bill, it's not saying it's disallowed. It's not saying you can't do that. All the bills that I've seen would promote is that if you do litigate, then the judge or jury gets to see both numbers. They get to see what your healthcare provider billed and what your healthcare provider paid. And then the judge and jury would decide how much you would be, how much you would be entitled to.
Tim, we got 90 seconds left. Let me jump in here. For people that say, well, you go to Texas and the insurance rates are here, you go to Mississippi and you do that, why is it not just as simple as saying, okay, let's change the law and do exactly what Texas or Mississippi does?
Well, look, we would have to change a wholesale. You can't just pick one or two and expect that. I mean, if we want to be like Texas, we have to adopt a whole set of regulations from the Department of Insurance, a whole set of tort law from Texas, same with Mississippi or Alabama or anybody else. I mean, what we're trying to do is address what drives losses in Louisiana. Why do we have twice the number of bodily injury claims? Why do we litigate twice the national average? That's what these laws are doing. If we want to be like these states, we need to do things to bend the curve downward on the number of claims that we say were hurt. I mean, to have twice the national, average of bodily injury claims would suggest that we have brittle bones in Louisiana. We don't. So why do we do that? Why do we say we're injured? Why do we litigate? These bills are designed to bring more transparency to the process and bring the premiums down through lower claims. Premiums follow claims. If you reduce the amount insurance companies pays out, the premiums will follow.
What is the best, Tim, we only have a second left. What's the best possible case that we can expect for auto rates after this session? You've been around a while. What do you think?
Well, look, I mean, last year we passed 2-year prescriptions. So now people have an additional year before they file litigation. I think 2 years on the outset. But insurance companies, look, if we pass all this legislation that's strong, I'm going to pressure insurance companies by saying, guys, give us the credit. I can't make them do it, but I can certainly engage in conversations. Say we're passing strong legislation. Bet on the good outcome in Louisiana and start to get more competitive.
The only thing I would say also is put the damn phone down. Pay attention to what you're doing. Thank you, Tim Temple, Louisiana Insurance Commissioner. We'll talk to Scott Walker, Jefferson Parish Council member, when we come back, about water meter readings and taking pictures and all that stuff right now. Time for WWL First News. 8:46, 14 till 9, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Some rain coming in throughout the week, starting tomorrow, but today is going to be nice and spring-like, so enjoy that while you can. Scott Walker joins us now. Sure, he's a Jefferson Parish Council member, but more importantly, he's the son of the oldies king, Bob Walker. How you doing, Scott?
Morning, Tommy. Nothing like starting a Monday with you.
Yeah, let me say this, too, about the old man. He's got his, and I'll give him a little plug here, Yacht Radio 690. Is that his website? What is it?
YachtRadio.com, yeah.
YachtRadio.com.
Does the things he used to do, and he's got a nice little online audience, and he does some live shows during the week, and people love it.
So if you miss all those oldies who used to play on Cool 95.7, all those New Orleans oldies, you can find them there. And I'll just give the old man a little plug because he and I worked together for a long time. Tell me about what's going on with water meters in Jefferson Parish and the genesis of all of this, how it started.
Well, for a few years now, we've gotten complaints daily from constituents that have discrepancies with their water meter reading. Either they feel like the meter's not being read, or the readings are inaccurate, or their bills are astronomically high, and there's no explanation for it as far as they can see. So they contact us, we look into it, and typically, most of the cases are solvable. It's either a leak that's discovered on the homeowner side, or a leak that's discovered on the parish side, and if it's on the parish side, we fix it. Of course, it's on the homeowner side, it's on the homeowner to fix it. But there are some that are sort of in the gray area. So this contract amendment that we did at our last council meeting to Olameter, our third-party meter reading company, makes them a little bit more accountable, makes them take a photograph of the meters that are out of whack, either 200% above their normal level or 50% below their normal level over a yearly average. And that prompts them to take a picture, and that picture would be available with a meter reading if any constituents have a question about whether it was read, how it was read, what the reading was, and where it all lands. So it's something that we hope brings more transparency and accountability to the process. And this is sort of just a bridge to get us from now to when we replace all of our meters over the next few years with the new smart meter technology that'll render all of this conversation useless, and their readings will be much more accurate and dependable.
So how do they know if it's 200% above? Somehow they have a interface with the phone or something. When they enter the numbers in, it pops up a warning or something, and then they take a picture?
Yeah. On the equipment, when they scan the number, the meter, it triggers an alert. And right now, Olameter can bypass that alert, and it triggers our water department to then go and look at that meter a second time to see what's going on. This now forces them to take the picture on the spot and not bypass that alert anymore, and free up our water department to do other things and not go out to the meter unless they absolutely have to.
Tell me about the elections and the renewals in Jefferson Parish and how important it was. They all passed, I think, right?
Yeah, they all passed overwhelmingly, which was great. And I know things are tight for people right now, and there was a lot of no sentiment out there, but I kept telling people, these are millages that were renewals. They weren't new taxes, and they are critical to the basic operation of government. They're not anything extra. They're for recreation, libraries, and drainage, 50% of the drainage budget, 90-plus percent of libraries and recreation. So if those would have gone away, then you would have seen libraries closed. You would have seen playgrounds closed. You would have seen programming cut. You would have seen drainage not drained to the capabilities that we do. And some of the pushback was, well, we've had this for 10 years. My street still floods. And I say, well, it's not in your house. That's typically what we do in Jefferson Parish. Is the system is designed to keep the water in the streets. And typically, outside of some isolated incidents, it doesn't get inside people's homes. And that's the goal. And drainage is good in Jefferson Parish, considering where we live and what we've been through. And this keeps that going. It keeps the operations going, keeps the maintenance going, keeps some of the new innovations going and things like that. But it can only be used for the purposes that it's authorized for. That is it. Some people say that you're using this for this or that or whatever, but it can only be used for what it's authorized for. And that's why it's so important. It is strictly dedicated millage money that has to go to drainage, recreation.
If you're a parent or share a fridge with someone, Instacart is about to make grocery shopping so much easier. Because with family carts, you can share a cart with your partner and each add the items you want. Since between the two of you, odds are you'll both remember everything you need. And this way, you'll never have to eat milkless cereal again. So minimize the stress of the weekly shop with family carts. Download the Instacart app and get delivery in as fast as 30 minutes. Plus, enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first three orders. Service fees apply for three orders in 14 days. Excludes restaurants.
MLB.tv is home to baseball's biggest stars. Watch every out-of-market game, live or on demand.
He got it! This is unbelievable!
Plus, you'll get 24/7 access to MLB Network. Stream every big pitch.
He struck him out!
Every home run.
Gone!
Everything baseball. All season long on MLB.tv. Start a free trial today. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
I'm Emma Greed, and I've spent the last 20 years building, running, and investing in some incredible businesses. The more success I've had, the more people started coming to me with questions. How do you start a business? How do you raise money? How do I bounce back from failure? On my new podcast, Aspire with Emma Greed, I'll be answering these questions and more through weekly conversations with the smartest minds out there. Listen to and follow Aspire with Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast, available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
And libraries.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up here. We come back. Y'all got any questions, comments? Scott Walker, 504-260-1870. And I was thinking about this over the weekend, about these millages that were up. And the one for the Orleans Parish Sheriff's Office, again, if you don't know, it passed by 2 votes. So if you don't think your vote counts, it does. I know Plaquemines Parish, they had a millage up. 2,400 people voted. I was one of those 2,400. And it's sad, really, how so few people take part in the process, but then do nothing but complain. But I was thinking about, and I'll address this with Scott when we come back, about this millage thing. You don't put them on in perpetuity because you want to make sure that the politicians are responsible with the money. But then, as Scott was saying about, you know, the streets still flood, well, there are ongoing expenses. It's not necessarily all about capital expenditures. And it just seems like that's, you can either judge politicians by electing them or not voting for the millage renewals. And it seems as though the Jefferson Parish government, if you will, got two hearty thumbs up in the way both of these passed. We'll pick it up when we come back. 8:51 traffic now, WWL. I-857, back to Scott Walker, Jefferson Parish Council member. When we started this off a couple minutes ago, you said something about starting your week with me. Was that cracking wise there or not?
No. Okay. No better way to start a Monday than with Tommy Tucker on WWL.
Okay, all right, because I'll call the old man on you. I know your mom, too. I'll let her know as well. Let's talk about this brew pub in Jefferson Parish and the meeting last week and where we stand on all of that.
It's been a contentious issue for a year and a half now, and I've stayed consistent with my vote. It's a District 1 project that was shepherded in by former District 1 Councilman Marion Edwards. Each district had $12.5 million at their discretion, federal money that was available after the pandemic. And that's what he decided to put his money towards, a transformational project in District 1. And I supported that, and I still support that. The lease was made during a time when things were different during COVID, and it's designed to attract a person or a company like Port Orleans to come in and spur economic development. And I think it's going to be a great development for Gretna and for the West Bank and for Jefferson Parish.
You know, one thing I missed, and I know you're a former journalist, or you might still, I don't know, notice that Scott said the design is to keep the water in the street, someone telling the truth about our drainage design. And that is interesting that somebody heard it that way. Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's we live in a bowl, and our drainage works really well. You want to see how it doesn't work? Don't fund it through a millage where 50% of the budget is lost. Mm-hmm. Our drainage, you see when a storm comes how quickly our water typically gets out. I mean, if your street's flooded, it's gone in an hour usually, maybe less. It collects. We get a lot of rain. It collects. It drains. I mean, the system is working as designed. Yes, it's an old system, but it is working. Our drainage system works. We may get some puddling. We may get some flooding, but it's going to go away. But we're never going to stop the flooding. No matter how great our drainage system is, the flooding is going to continue, and we're going to have these heavy rains, and we're going to have this persistent street flooding in areas that have experienced it for a long time.
We maintain,
we make it better in spots, and hopefully lessen it in some of those areas.
What you just said, my younger, taller friend, is the truth, and it applies to Orleans Parish as well, and everybody needs to remember that as we go into what could be a rainy week. Thank you, Scott. Tell the parents hi for me.
Thanks, Tommy.
You bet. Scott Walker, Jefferson Parish Council member. We'll come back. Talk to Karen McCord. Her daughter, Carly McCord, killed tragically in an airline accident. We'll talk about her story when we return on WWL. Into the 9 o'clock hour we go, 9:09. It was interesting. I was talking to Scott Walker just now, and I know that young man from when he was just a kid, when I was working with his dad at the Oldie Station, and he would come into work, and I watched Scott's career advance. He went to Mobile as a newsman. A lot of people know of him as the leprechaun guy. I don't know if you remember that story or not, but if you look it up, you can find it. Now he's an elected official, and it's a shame. First of all, it's so hard for somebody to find their way through the business that I'm in, this type of business. And it's a shame when somebody does find their way and have their way kind of going and plotted that it gets cut tragically short. And that's what happened to Carly McCord. And with that, we welcome in Karen McCord. Karen McCord, her mom, author of Only Rainbows, The Carly McCord Story. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. And by the way, my dad was Joe Collotter, and Let's Talk It Over. And
oh, sure.
Bob Walker.
Absolutely. Was he really?
Yes.
Yeah, I remember.
He worked with Bob Walker, and Carly worked with GSU, not with Scott, but, you know, knew of Scott.
Man, I remember that that Joe Collotta. That was on Sunday afternoon. That was growing up when he would do the public affairs show, I think, right, on WTIS?
Yeah, and then he did Let's Talk It Over.
Right.
For many years, for probably 30 years, yeah.
It's a small world, I'll tell you what. Let's talk about First of all, and I tell you this before, but I mean it sincerely, I am so sorry for your loss, because there is nothing I can imagine worse than a parent losing a child. It's just not the natural order of things, and I don't know how you ever get over that or continue on with your life. And I pray for parents every night that have lost children, and your name has been added to that list for whatever it's worth. But tell me about, I guess, the Carly McCord story. Let's talk about what happened, and then we'll work back and fill in the details, okay?
Good. That sounds good. Well, that is the reason why I wrote the book, was for me to get through the grief. And so that is, of course, what spurred me to that. But as your audience probably knows, on December 28, 2019, Carly was going to the game, to the Peach Bowl, to do some reporting and that sort of thing. And because she worked for the New Orleans Saints and the Pels, she had a Pelicans game that week, she had to fly there. And so the night before she got on the plane, interestingly enough, she did tell me, she says, "I'm kind of nervous about getting on this plane, and I don't know why." Mm. And did she have a premonition? Probably so. I think she did. I think she had some kind of gnawing something. But she was diligent, and she needed to get to work, so she decided to get on the plane. As you know, or as your audience might know, her father-in-law was coaching that game. Mm-hmm. He wasn't the head coach, but he was the offensive coach, Steve Ensminger. And so she was flying to the game to watch the game and to see him win, as well as to report it. And then the rest, of course, is history. The plane went down and tragedy struck. And my life and my family's life, of course, changed forever.
Well, you said you wrote the book as partially, I guess, a cathartic kind of thing, but you also wanted people to know about Carly's work ethic and what, how she had it, I guess, for want of a better phrase, she had a career pretty well outlined, and she was making some steady progress, right?
Correct. In fact, one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book was that she almost was Miss Louisiana. She was first runner-up twice. She almost got the Saints Super Bowl ring because she was working for the Saints. And, of course, the organization gets, I don't know if they get rings or if they have to purchase rings, but if the organization wins, then, you know, the whole area, the whole staff has an option for a ring. Mm-hmm. And she was there on the 20-yard line covering the game when the no-call hit with Drew Brees. And so she almost got the ring. And then at the end, she was ready to sign on with an NFL network, and she almost got there, and she almost made her whole dreams and her career dream come true, and then, of course, the plane crashed. So I always told my husband that I am going to make this book nationally a success, because she always was fourth down in inches, and she never crossed that goal line, that pinnacle goal line. And so so I am trying to make her cross that goal line with this book.
Let's talk about the book itself. When it comes to the Carly that you knew that we didn't know, that from the TV persona, what's the difference?
Not much. She was a little bit more grumpy, I guess, toward us. You know, if we told her no, she would say yes. But other than that, she was really funny. She was funny. She was goofy. She never took herself too seriously. But boy, did she work. You know, even at 14, she would have three jobs because she loved to work. She loved to do that, be busy. And so when she got into the sports arena, and she was busy, she absolutely loved it. For example, she would jump from the Pelicans to the high school football, to the college scene, to the New Orleans Saints, and then on Monday morning shows, you know, and then over again, repeat. And so she was just the hard worker. But, you know, she was also, like I mentioned, she was silly and goofy. She would sit in the middle of the Superdome and do her hair and look at the people and say, look, I'm sitting on prime real estate in about 3 hours. Hmm. And she would, you know, she loved the dome. She knew every inch of the dome. And she loved New Orleans. Now, she was an NFL girl. She started off in Cleveland. And, you know, she was very well known in the NFL, but she winded up working for the New Orleans Saints and WDSU. She came home because she loved New Orleans.
My kid went to Northwestern State as well and graduated. That's where Carly McCord went to school, graduated. Tell me about her college days and so forth.
Well, her college days were interesting. She, you read in the book that she entered the pageant world a little bit under duress, and it's a hilarious story. But she winded up being Miss Lady of the Bracelet there. And when she captured that title, and Lady of the Bracelet is pretty much Miss Northwestern. And when she captured the title there, she actually got to work and sing, because her talent was singing. She would sing at the baseball games. She would sing at the basketball games. She would cover the football games. And she got she got to learn how to speak very well. And so she was around sports a lot in the NFL, I mean, at Natchitoches. And so that began to spur her love of sports. However, I will say she graduated as a criminal justice major, wanted to be a lawyer, but winded up getting a job in the NFL for the Cleveland Browns. And she actually was one of the first female scouts for the NFL. So she actually did some scouting for the
really?
For the NFL and for the Cleveland Browns. Yes. And it was so interesting because people didn't realize that about her. As you said earlier, what did we realize about her? We knew that she didn't, you know, maybe you didn't know. But she was an NFL scout. She was a character scout. And she would look, she would go on spring break and look at the character of the players, which was a very new position back then, but it's very common now. And one tiny fact is when Michael Lombardi got fired and they cleaned house, of course, she lost her job. And in her exit interview, she told Ray Farmer, who was going to be the new general manager, she told him, I would not draft Johnny Manziel. He's not a good draft pick. And, Michael Lombardi always says that she would have saved Cleveland a lot of money if they would have listened to her.
Mm. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. We're talking to Karen McCord. The book is Only Rainbows, a Carly McCord story. Mike Dettelier let us know about this. He was a good friend of the family, I guess, really. And it was so tragic on the way to the LSU. Was it the SEC championship game? Yes, right?
Yep. Yeah.
And died in a plane crash, a small plane crash, and we'll talk more about that. I see here you say that our grief journeys are filled with indescribable color if we can find a way to hold on to its memory. And I want to talk to you about that when we come back, Karen, about parents that have lost children or are gone through some tragedies. How do you manage to hang on to the color parts of the memories and not let the pain creep in? 9:19, Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. It is 9:25, talking to Karen McCord, mother of Carly McCord, and author of Only Rainbows, the Carly McCord story. A great read. It's 426 pages, but it goes by very, very quickly. When it comes to that day, that December day, December 28th, the Peach Bowl, LSU's playing, and Carly gets on the plane, and you said there was some misgivings beforehand, right? She had almost like a premonition of something bad happening?
Yeah, she did. She actually looked at me the night before and she said, Mom, I just don't feel good about this plane. And I looked at her and I said, then don't get on it. Mm-hmm. And she goes, but I have to get on it. I have to get on it for work. And, you know, I want to go see my father-in-law achieve his dream. And so she was adamant about getting on the plane. And as moms do always, I told her, call me when you get there. Now, what good is that? I don't know. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we as parents say that.
Yes, we do.
And, You know, there's a story, however, that goes like this. After the plane crash, I was at my grief counselor, because you really can't do this without grief counseling, or at least I couldn't do it without grief counseling. And my therapist looked at me and she said, "Karen, what was the worst day of your life?" And I said, "Well, you know." And she goes, "No, stay with me." And I said, "December 28th, 2019. And she said, "What would you have done differently?" And I said, "I would have, you know, stopped the plane. I would have hung on the wings. I would have slashed her tires to get there." And she goes, "Ah, so you would have played God." Mm-hmm. And I said, "No, I would have played Mom." And she said, "Exactly. Don't you think God could have stopped that plane if he wanted to?" And I said, "Absolutely." And she goes, "Karen, it wasn't yours to change. It was her time." And deep in my soul, I realized that she was correct. And so, you know, I stopped blaming myself for her not getting on the plane. But it took a lot of soul searching, a lot of writing. I wrote this book by pen and paper, and you could see the tear spots on the notes. I interviewed over 100 people, and I laughed with them, and I cried with them. But that's how I got through my grief. And then the other part of getting through my grief is that this is a book that parents who have lost children, or even people who have lost moms, dads, sisters, brothers, they can read it, and they could say, "I can get it through it too." And hopefully it's a gift to them, that they could see that through grief, you can have healing. It's going to be a new normal, but you can have healing.
Well, take me back to the when you got the call. How did you find out? Because again, that's every parent's worst nightmare, right?
Right. It is. In fact, you probably, being in the media, might have known it before I did. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any radio, television on, and it hit media before they even contacted us. And I was in Fresh Market, and Fresh Market is a grocery store in Baton Rouge, and we were buying all kind of goodies and that sort of thing because we were prepared for a party. You know, we were all excited that, you know, LSU was playing, and we were going to have people over and preparing for a party. I got into my car, and all of a sudden, one of her her dear friends, who was a bridesmaid in her wedding, actually went ahead and went ahead and called me and said, "Is it true?" And I said, "What's true?" And she said, "The plane crash." And it was at that moment that I realized something terrible had happened. But it was all over the news before we actually had the news in our midst.
It's December 28th as well when this happened. Has that affected the holidays for you all moving forward, or do you look at it as a time to celebrate her life?
You know, it's interesting. That's a great question, because I'm going to tell you why. December 28th was the worst day of my life. And then December 29th was Kaylee's birthday. That's my oldest daughter's birthday. Mm-hmm. And we had tried to have kids for over 9 years. And so basically that was the most joyous day of our lives, or one of the most joyous days of our lives. So I always say December 28th was Good Friday, and then December 29th was our Easter, you know, and it's kind of weird how that worked out. But yes, to answer your question, you know, holidays will never be the same, but we have a new normal, and we've made some new traditions, because I do suggest parents do that, or people who lose, you know, loved ones, that they go ahead and change their traditions up and not do necessarily the same things. And you can reinvent the holidays as you reinvent yourself.
Can you be as excited about LSU as you were before? And LSU has nothing to do with any of this, but you understand what I'm saying, because it's omnipresent everywhere. You can't avoid it. It's all over.
It's everywhere. That's a really good question, because the answer to that is that no, you know, football season comes, my stomach gets into a little bit of a knot. Baseball season comes, and she covered baseball. She covered the Saints. She covered the Pelicans. And so every time I see, you know, a newscaster or a girl sportscaster on the sidelines, I just, it just breaks my heart. And through this experience, I befriended Michelle Tafoya, and I don't know if you know who she is or not, but she was a real big sportscaster, and she had me on her show. And I always say I looked at Michelle, and Michelle was Carly's mentor. And when I talk to Michelle, even on when she's on Gutfeld, I just look at it and I still think of Carly. And so, yes, the signs are everywhere, and it's definitely in the sports world. However, can I share a Kim Mulkey story, or do we have time?
No, good. That's fine.
Okay. Interestingly enough, my husband and I, there was one sport that Carly did not cover, and it was the women's LSU basketball team. So right after the accident, Kim Mulkey came to LSU, I think it was in 2021, and I was invited to go to a luncheon. And I probably was the only one in Baton Rouge who didn't know who Kim Mulkey was, okay? I'm not a big basketball fan, and so, you know, a dribble means spilling water on me. And so anyway, I went to the a luncheon with Kim Mulkey, and didn't know who Kim Mulkey was, and all of a sudden she came up to me, and she said, "I am so sorry about your daughter." And she hugged me and talked to me for about 15 minutes. And she told me about her granddaughter who had died when she was very, very little, when she was, I think, first born. You know, like it was, you know, she didn't live very, very long. And we talked as two, as a mom and two, as a grandmother who lost children. And we just talked to each other and hugged each other. And I looked at her and I said, "Kim," I said, "there's a line a mile long waiting to talk to you." And she goes, "That's okay, Karen. They can wait because this is more important." And so anyway, because of that exchange, Tracy and I started to go to the LSU basketball games, the women's basketball games, and we followed them. And we followed them the season that they won the national championship. And we actually even went to the national championship. And it was the first time, Tommy, that we could go to a sport, watch the sport, and not be reminded of Carly, because it wasn't Carly's sport at all. It was Tracy and I's. And so we still, to this day, follow the LSU women's basketball team, and we always say that this is the sport, you know, that we love, you know. And so it was kind of our healing sport.
Would you say this book is more about helping parents who've lost children, or helping parents enjoy the time that they have with the kids now, or both?
I think it's both. I absolutely do think it's both, because I enjoy Carson and Kaylee even more because I know the time with them is precious. However, I will say that when I was given the book, it always helps me in the grief process. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write The Only Rainbows, is because books helped me. Another book that helped me a lot was The Shack. And I would read it and read it over and over again because I could put myself in his place. And so I wanted people to understand that if they needed help with their grieving process, that they could go to Only Rainbows, read it, get what they need out of it, maybe laugh a little bit, cry a lot, and realize that they're not alone.
Thank you so much for taking the time with us, Karen. The name of the book is The Carly Only Rainbows, The Carly McCord Story. For people that don't know, why Only Rainbows?
Oh, because those were her last words. It was an Instagram post, and she wrote on an Instagram post, "Only rainbows after rain, the sun will always come again." And so because of that, we decided to to name the book that. Why she wrote that, though, we don't know. We won't know that until I get into the other side. But yes, you can buy Only Rainbows, and you can order it on Amazon and Barnes and Nobles, and you know, anywhere you can get books.
It's an amazing story, well written, and I'm so sorry for your loss, Karen.
Oh, thank you so much for having me and for sharing this time with me. I'm so honored. And yes, Mike D'Attilia is fabulous. He read in Carly's story, and he is in the book.
Yes, he is. Thank you, Karen. God bless y'all. Karen McCord. The book is Only Rainbows, a Carly McCord story. You can get it at all the usual outlets. We're going to take a break. We come back. We'll talk to Ed Michelle, New Orleans Inspector General, about the permits office and the mess that's going on there. 937, 23 till 10. Traffic now, WWL. 9:44, 16 till 10. Tommy Tucker, WWL. Time really does fly, because it was back in 2019 that the Hard Rock collapse happened, and that's when we started to find out a lot about the permitting department. But how much has changed between now and then in 4 years? Well, let's find out. Ed Michelle joins us, New Orleans Inspector General, who has got a new report out that talks about inspections and permits and third-party inspectors and all that. Good morning, Ed. How are you?
Good morning, Tommy. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming on. Tell me what prompted the report and what investigation, whatever you want to call it, and what you found.
Well, this was an audit of was a performance audit of safety and permits, focusing on inspections performed by third party inspectors, and you know, the scope of this audit was all building, mechanical, and electrical permit inspections conducted by third-party inspectors during 2022. But before we discuss this audit, I wanted to share and to keep in mind that our 2022 audit of safety and permits, we discovered that city inspectors actually, you know, didn't show up for inspections for about 20% of the inspections. Wait. We tested in person.
What was the time frame on that?
So in our audit that we conducted in 2022, we discovered that city inspectors did not perform in-person inspections for about 20% of the audits we tested. And we also determined that the city inspectors didn't spend an adequate amount of time conducting these inspections if they actually did show up.
So what happens when they didn't show up, or if they didn't spend the adequate time, what was the result?
Well, those inspections were passed nonetheless. So, it's critical. You know, it's also important to note that city inspectors have GPS in their vehicles, so we can actually confirm, you know, if they arrived at the site, how long that they were at the inspection site. Whereas third party inspectors, which was the focus of this audit, they may not have GPS in their vehicles, and if they do, safety and permits may not have access to that information. So The purpose of this audit was to verify that safety and permits implemented adequate policies and procedures for inspections performed by third-party inspectors, and to verify if third-party inspectors complied with safety and permits policies and procedures.
Did they?
Well, so one other thing to keep in mind. So last year, the city had about 28,000 inspections in 2022, actually. 31% of those, which was about 8,800, were conducted by city inspectors, but third-party inspectors conducted about 19,000, which is about 68% of the total inspections. Mm-hmm. So, improperly performed inspections, and you asked me why we did this, mm-hmm. this audit, improperly performed inspections could lead to catastrophic and deadly situations, as well as significant litigation against the city. And it's imperative that safety and permits ensures that third-party inspectors perform their inspections in compliance, and to make certain that buildings and work performed comply with the applicable codes. You want to jump into what we found?
Yeah, let me take a step back real quick for people that don't know it, have never been through the process. There are building codes when it comes to electric, when it comes to plumbing. Things have to be done a certain way. And that's why the inspector comes out to make sure that you got to have a permit from the city. And the inspector comes out to make sure that everything's being done properly before the walls are sealed up. Because, like Ed was talking about with catastrophic stuff with electricity or plumbing or be it foundation or whatever it is, you want to make sure that it's done right before it's hidden away. And that's why the city has inspectors, and you heard about either not showing up or not spending enough time there and it passing anyway. And now we're talking about third-party inspectors, and the question is, who's inspecting the third-party inspectors? That, I'm guessing, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And our first finding, Tommy, revealed that Safety and Permits had actually not hired a full-time compliance officer, as they had committed to doing so to resolve the findings of our prior audits. And so the compliance officer position is important because it's responsible for quality reviews of inspections performed not only by third-party inspectors, but city inspectors as well. And having a compliance officer on staff can lead to efforts to prevent and detect compliance risk. During this audit, we discovered that third-party inspectors did not submit inspection reports for about 44% of the inspections tested. So in this case, third-party inspectors didn't submit the required photographs, and our sampling was 93 inspections. And in all 93 inspections, we didn't find any of the photographs that should have been included in your normal inspection. And let's talk about what those photographs are and what they mean. The required photographs must include the exterior address of the inspection site, a photograph of inspectors at the inspection site, and a photograph of inspectors at the site with their credentials. This photographic documentation is necessary because it confirms that the inspector conducted an adequate inspection of the permitted work, as well as confirm that they were actually present at the site. Because you remember the last inspection audit we did, we determined that some of the inspectors simply just weren't showing up. So it's critical that they actually take these photos and include them in the report. And in this case, they did not include them at all.
Let me take a step back here, Ed. Who is vetting these third-party inspectors? Who's approving those? Or is, because you said the what position was not filled?
Oh, so the compliance officer position wasn't filled. So, you know, now keep in mind, city individuals that are having these plans done can contact the city, right, and hire a city inspector, or they can hire a third-party inspector of their own choosing. So this is either way, either route that a prospective builder or citizen takes to have their work reviewed, that's up to them. And so these third-party inspectors are out there doing this work, but as we found, you know, in the first finding, they're not even taking these photographs. We also discovered that they didn't, that Safety and Permits didn't even implement an inspection checklist, not only for third-party inspectors, but for city inspectors as well. We tested a sample of 93 permits, and we found that in 100% of the inspections that we tested, there was no checklist performed at all. And a checklist is needed to help the inspectors ensure more comprehensive inspection. And again, we did a previous audit and recommended that they conduct a checklist policy, but they never actually created it, and they didn't actually provide it to third-party inspectors.
One thing I just want to throw in here is that people can get, when you say people can get their own third-party inspector, a lot of times that's the contractor that the people are doing business with that gets a third-party inspector, right?
That's correct. Right. And I just want to reiterate that the reason why checklists are so important is because these checklists can be used to provide a specific data on the building and any deficiencies that the building may have. So as a result of the delay in the creation of the checklist, we can project that third-party inspectors did not submit, you know, the required inspection checklist for about 16,000 inspections conducted in 2022. Let's talk about why these licenses are so important. If you don't mind.
I want to talk about that, and I want to get to where we go from here with this. We only have a couple of minutes left because this disturbs the hell out of me.
Yeah, so third-party licenses provide proof of certifications, which validates their expertise to perform these functions. And in some cases, Safety and Permits approved inspections that were submitted by third-party inspectors with expired licenses. Mm. So we need to really make sure that this is consistent, and we like I said before, really bad things can happen. We also determined that safety improvements didn't conduct quarterly meetings with third party inspectors. Can we, since we don't have much time, do you want me to jump into the recommendations?
Please.
So based on our findings, our first recommendation was that they actually should create a full-time compliance officer position whose primary duties include performing these quality inspections. Safety and permits indicated that they were going to hire this compliance officer in the first quarter of 2023, Tommy, but they actually didn't hire this building inspector until 2 years later, around March 17th of 2025. But we have hope now that this new compliance officer is going to review and perform these building electrical and mechanical inspections, and will actually be able to identify and mitigate these risks.
Let me ask one question real quick before we run out of time, Ed, and that is this. If there is a shady contractor doing work in Orleans Parish and he wants to get his own third-party inspector, no pictures are being provided of this, and seal up the walls with sub-code work, that would be pretty easy to do right now, would it not?
Well, I think because of the attention that has been focused on this now, there's no greater motivation than sunshine, right?
And I'm not trying to encourage anybody to do this. I'm just trying to warn people that hire contractors. That's all.
Yes. So if people have some concerns, you know, people spend their life savings for a house or to build or to correct the necessary repair. So if they think they've gotten a faulty inspection or they think that the inspection wasn't performed up to code, they can always hire an independent contractor. And if people believe that this is going on, we have a hotline at NOLA at www.nolaoig.gov, and you can call our hotline or you can submit a tip anonymously.
Thank you, Ed. I hope you can come back and talk about this some other time, because we never have enough time. We'll talk to Noel when we come back, see what he's got planned. But there's no reason not to have a picture when you just take one with your phone of what's behind the walls. And 93 out of 93 times, no picture? Come on, man. We'll be back. WWL.